Okay, welcome everyone to council work session following up on a very long and informative hearing last week to go over the Private for Hire Innovation Task Force's report. I think we have a team of people, is that correct, Commissioner Novick, lined up to walk us through answers to these questions that
small
council
team
raised. So Ken McGarr and Jim, I think. Who else?
Brian,
come on up.
Well, I think first we're going to start report from the committee chair.
Okay, sorry. We'll start with the committee chair and vice chair, and then we'll move on to staff from there. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Welcome back.
Thank you. Yesterday, I underwent a couple of medical procedures unrelated to the task force work. And so I've asked Joan to read the statement, but I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right. Good to see you all again. Thanks for having us back. What we kind of wanted to do is provide a little bit of rationale for the information that we provided you or the recommendations that we provided you last week. I want to talk a little bit just briefly about the scope of recommendations, and then I want to talk about some kind of specific areas: safety, equity and accessibility, operational issues, and program administration. And I will do it as quickly as I possibly can. Under 10, shooting for 5. So that's where I'm. That's about what I've got. So the scope of our recommendations, the task force was charged with developing a regulatory framework to accommodate the entry of TNCs into Portland. We intentionally did not address questions related to whether or not they should be. We were asked to look at safety issues and consumer protection issues, and so that was the gist of our recommendation for the first 120 days. Our recommendations were for just the interim period. We recognize there's questions about some of the whys and hows, which is no surprise, given that it was an abbreviated time frame. The task force, we had 10 meetings. Some of you heard our recommendations for the first time last week, so I understand you certainly had questions. To a great extent, we are going to see how phase one works. We want to see what works, keep the things that do, and rethink the ones that don't. So that's kind of where we started with. So just quickly on safety, background checks, our goal was to modify the existing requirements for both taxis and TNCs to make it easier and quicker to qualify new drivers and to help reduce the city's administrative burden. The recommendations allow all companies to employ third-party companies to do background checks. The standards have to meet or exceed city codes, including the record-keeping requirements. And the city is going to verify that those background checks are done correctly through an audit process and record-keeping through the permitting process. As far as vehicle inspections and driver testing, about the only issue we heard on vehicle inspections last week in terms of your questions were related to the requirement for fire extinguishers. And as I mentioned last week, we got input from the National Institute for Automotive Service Excellence, and they said that they were not as viewed as a critical safety feature. So one of the things we were doing is trying to minimize regulations that may or may not be necessary, but I think the task force wouldn't, certainly if you guys wanted to change that requirement, we wouldn't be upset by that, or anything you want to change for that matter, don't get me wrong. As far as for driver testing and training, there's no differences between taxis and TNCs, and we're just trying to make it easier and quicker for new drivers to get into the system and help reduce the city's administrative burden. As far as insurance, to the extent feasible, we wanted to achieve equivalency for what's required for taxis and TNCs. So except for period one, we've recommended requiring the same types of insurance and the same or greater levels of coverage for the TNCs and the taxis. I'll leave it at that. And again, this
period one
is the app on before there's a match with a customer or rider. And so the other two are en route two, once you've had a match, and person in car is period three. So Cameras in vehicles was another issue that came up. Our understanding is essentially that the same level of driver and passenger safety is achieved through cameras in vehicles or through the information that's contained in the apps. So that was why we went there. The second one of the four that I wanted to cover are equity and accessibility. I can't emphasize enough how important this is to the task force. I mean, that really was one of our main focuses. In the interim period, what we wanted to do is to use what we have at our disposal and ensure that timely and equitable service is provided to people with disabilities. In this phase, collect data and review the variety of service and funding options with PEEP, which is Portland Equal Access Plan that you heard about, kind of as the basis for where we think we should go. For both TNCs and taxis, the requirement would be wheelchair accessible vehicles or WAV is the acronym, I guess, be provided through direct service or through a contracted service. We agree with last week's suggestion that there be a prohibition against charging higher fees for accessible service. We want to immediately require data reporting on wait time for all passengers so we have something to measure against for all passengers. And then on the issue of cash versus credit card payments, we think there's some feasible options for the people without credit cards. And we also heard the Taxi Fairness Alliance suggested, I won't speak for them, but I kind of got from what they said, that they might not accept cash if they weren't required to do so. So operational issues is our third area. Our goal was to enable different fare programs in order to assess how consumers respond. We wanted to provide certainty to consumers by retaining the regulated rates for taxis, ensure transparency, and limit possible administrative chaos by taking away the current system that the taxi cabs have for fares. For both TNCs and taxis, you have to know what the fare is up front, or at least what it's based on, and receipts are required. And then the city, of course, retained the ability to regulate dynamic pricing if there was an emergency or surge pricing, I think is the word that gets used. As far as administration, data reporting, the last area that I want to talk about is it's a critical component to our recommendations. We heard that the system is broken on many fronts, and to craft appropriate and meaningful solutions, we need some basic data. We want to establish a data-based framework that enables measurements of compliance with the regulations, enforcement, and assessments of the effects of the changes that are being proposed. We want to obtain that information on a monthly basis, as quickly as possible, and we want to ensure privacy of information. As far as the permitting program, as with a number of our regulations, again, we were trying to make it easier and quicker to permit both companies and drivers and to reduce the city's administrative burden. Our recommendation is to allow the taxis and the TNCs to complete background checks, insurance inspections, and vehicle inspections. And we also recommend issuance of an unrestricted number of permits for the first 120 days to taxis and TNCs. In phase two, we would propose to develop measures to access the market capacity. To expedite permitting, we're also recommending transfer of the permitting authority to the commissioner in charge, and the recommendation is also that all permits be processed uniformly. Fees, our goal was full cost recovery for the TNCs and to avoid an administrative headache associated with temporarily abandoning the taxi fee structure that could be resurrected in phase two. So for the 120 days, the recommendation to assess TNC's a flat fee and retain the taxi structure we thought would achieve that. In phase two, the idea is to develop a tiered structure based on the size of the company and full cost recovery for both taxis and TNCs. So that kind of hopefully gives you a little bit of our rationale for where we were coming from. We think that we've given this complex challenge a good first shot. We look forward to expanding our analysis in the next phase, looking at the full private-for-hire transportation system, and we're happy to explore any alternate solutions to address your concerns and enable the program to move forward.
Thank you very much.
Thank you both, and thanks all the members of the task force for the huge amount of work you put into this issue for us. So thank you.
And now, Brian Hockaday, assisted by Ken McGair and possibly Jody Yates, was going to just walk through answers to the specific questions that people had last week.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Council. My name is Brian Hockaday, Policy Advisor for Commissioner Novick. I mean, before we get into the questions asked and issues raised last week's hearing, I wanted to start off with three key findings. The oversupply of drivers relative to the limited number of tightly held taxi permits creates artificially poor market conditions for drivers, with too few incentives for companies to provide adequate services at reasonable cost to drivers. The evolution of business models across the U.S. and elsewhere is causing many jurisdictions to recognize a need for adjustments to taxi permitting systems and to add regulations regarding taxi company performance and the driver-company relationship. Currently, permitted drivers and companies alike deserve fair opportunities to meet the goals of safe, efficient, and sustainable taxi service. These three findings come from the 2012 Taxi Driver Labor Market Study. So for a while now, we have known that there are several issues with our current taxi system and the way that we regulate for hire transportation within the city of Portland. So today, we're not here to exclusively talk about Uber and other transportation network companies. And in many ways, what we're here to discuss are issues even bigger than Uber. And the reforms to the regulations and changes to the industry, these are a long time coming. And we are here today at a real tipping point where you have an opportunity to open up the door of opportunity to drivers, where we can substantially improve transportation options for people with disability, and where we can shift the paradigm of how we move, connect, and relate to one another in the city here in Portland. Again, last week you had an opportunity to really dig into the task force's recommendations, and I know that each of you have had the opportunity to speak with industry stakeholders. Last week there were several questions and issues raised at the hearing, and we're here today to provide you with information to address those questions and issues. And I'm joined by Michael Jacobs from PBOT and Kim McGair from the City Attorney's Office. And what we'd like to do is walk you through what we did is we went through the hearing last week, took down all the questions and issues raised, and have information in response to all of those. So unless Ken and Michael have anything that they would like to add, I think that we can just dive right in. So the information that is included in your binder.
You have all three on. Okay.
Thank you. So we'd like to start out with safety and service issues. And specifically to the vehicle inspections, there was a question asked about the fire extinguishers. And as Joan and the task force members have articulated already, staff, myself, I talked to ASE and asked for their opinion about the inclusion of fire extinguishers in vehicles, and they recommended that the fire extinguishers are not a key safety component for hire transportation vehicles, and they recommended that is not a crucial requirement.
So may I just ask a process question?
Sure.
How would you propose to get council discussion on each issue, or is that what we're going to do is go through each
Maybe
issue?
I would suggest let them run through the answers to our last set of questions, and then we can circle back.
Okay, well, except that they already answered that question before. So, but you want to just run through the answers, and then we go back again and go through?
I would recommend that.
Okay.
What do you think, Steve?
Yeah, and certainly if there's
a lot of work into answering the questions that came up, so I'd like to get a chance to answer our questions.
Sure. There was a question about vehicle signage and notice, and specifically Commissioner Frist asked about a requirement for audio recording, and I'd like to defer to Ken McGair from the City Attorney's on this particular point.
Sure. Ken McGair from the City Attorney's Office. Commissioner Fritz asked about audio recordings in vehicles, and I took it, and I think we presumed that you were considering using the actual application of the phone to record audio conversations. We didn't have any further details, but in-person audio recordings require the consent of all parties or the informed notice that you're being recorded at any given time. And that's not in and of itself an issue. You could put a sign in the car that says that the conversations are being recorded. I think there are some personal privacy issues there that aren't involved necessarily with regards to the cameras themselves. People are a little more wary that they're being recorded, their voice is being recorded. But the other aspect of it was the code currently for the camera images has pretty stringent data requirements about who can maintain the cameras and who can access the information on the cameras and for what purpose. And I think that would be a little bit difficult to do with audio recordings, but I'm not saying it's out of the realm of possibility. I'm just saying that there would be an issue about how the data on the audio recordings would be maintained by the individual TNC drivers, since they are kind of working as independent contractors by themselves. And where that would be, where the repository would be for that information.
Sorry. And another point of process I should mention before we really get too far into this is we certainly wanted to give an opportunity for different industry stakeholders to respond directly to questions and issues that you might have. And so if council is fine with that, we'd like to call up different people as we get to different issues. On to background checks, the task force is recommending that we allow taxi and TNC companies to utilize third-party background check vendors to perform background checks, so long as that they are complying with our background check requirements. This is actually not a change in city code, but really a change in practice. Currently, taxi companies are legally allowed to use third-party vendors, although as a point of practice, the City of Portland has been running background checks for drivers through the LEDS system, which really just checks state of Oregon arrests and convictions. We do get a notification if there is a out-of-state a conviction for any driver, and at that point, we require the driver to come in and get fingerprinted so that an FBI screen can be conducted.
Right. My understanding is the notification is not does not really provide detail.
Correct. Right. We get a multi-state offender notification.
And you say that the third party has to follow our standards. Are there any current differences between the third party background checks that have been proposed by any of the TNCs and our system?
No, it's really a matter of the requirements that the city sets. The third-party vendors just process those background checks, and all third-party background check vendors would they must verify that they're checking for all the things that we require for drivers.
But third parties don't check fingerprints. Is that right?
They get Social Security and other information, and upon a applicant's consent, that background check can be done without fingerprints, correct?
But, Commissioner, currently we don't check fingerprints either unless the FBI background check is requested, showing that there's a multi-state offense.
Right, so that means we do request fingerprints if there's indication
it goes
through
the
LEDS check that there's a multi-state offense.
Right, it goes to the FBI. That's how the FBI does the check, by fingerprint. Yep. And on the to follow up on your point about the disqualifying, we have the disqualifying factors in the code. They would be subject to the same disqualifying factors, and we had been in contact with the TNCs to ensure that their background checks could comply with all of those disqualifying factors. There was talk that because of Fair Credit Reporting Act requirements, they wouldn't be able to go back more than 7 years, but that's not accurate as to some of the aspects of our code. So they can comply with everything that's currently in the code.
So my understanding is that currently taxi drivers have to have been City of Portland residents for 5 years. Is that going to be the same for TNC drivers?
No, there is a series of requirements laid out in city code, and those requirements would be applied to both taxi and TNC drivers uniformly.
So does that include having been a Portland resident for 5 years?
We're pulling that specific language up right now, and we will clarify that.
So while you're looking at that, I have a question. In your written response, you say that we would audit about background checks. Do we currently know the names of all of the taxi drivers?
Yes, and we would be requiring the TNCs to provide a list of all of their drivers.
The challenge is that in other places there have been unpermitted drivers driving on a platform. So we won't know whether or not, now we know because we have the taxi companies, we have a limited number of permits, we won't know if they're giving us a complete list of all their drivers or not.
So we have a, this is a matter of enforcement about any driver who is on the road without the proper permit. That's an issue for both taxi and TNCs. But in terms of the TNC specifically, they would be required to provide us on a weekly basis an update of their drivers who are within the platform.
But we won't know whether they're giving us an accurate list.
I think the same applies to the taxi cabs, Commissioner. Taxi cabs could have unpermitted drivers operating their taxis now.
The industry reps say no. Could we get some?
It's physically, it's physically possible.
Could we get that information on that?
Sure.
And in fact, you know, we do have issues with companies who are headquartered outside of the city of Portland, who not only drop off passengers within the city of Portland, but then turn around and pick up passengers. So they are, you know, not permitted by the city of Portland, and that is and has been an issue for taxi specifically.
Right, and we periodically do enforcement on it.
Can I just follow up on the point you just made? In the submission we got from Uber dated April 13th, under data, they say we're deeply concerned about protecting the privacy of our riders and drivers. They talk about proprietary information and then wanting to protect the privacy and proprietary information. And I think you earlier said that the requirement would be that they have to furnish, all TNCs would have to furnish us with a list of their drivers. And is that subject to the same objection that is raised here about protecting the privacy of drivers, or have do you think we can work that issue out?
Yeah, I think this is a bit of a legal question. I'd like to defer to Kim McGarry.
I think we can work the issue out. What they're concerned about, Commissioner, is a public records request for a list of their drivers. They consider it proprietary in essence that their drivers are their customers or their independent contractors, and they're concerned that their competitors will come in and take their drivers away from them. But I think we can work it out in terms of a data sharing agreement, but also in terms of our ability to inspect the records. They're going to hold the records at their office, and we can go to the office and inspect them on site if we choose.
I don't want to get in the weeds on this, but I just want to understand. The city's proposal will be that they are required to furnish the information, including the names of their drivers, correct?
That is correct.
And how we get there legally will leave to our crack legal team, but that would be the code requirement. Okay.
And are we going to require the permit number to be posted? You know, we had this discussion with Airbnb. In order to be able to be on the platform, do they have to have a permit number posted?
So I think throughout this entire discussion, there are some notable differences in Airbnb and the TNCs. We are, you know, taxi drivers as independent contractors must obtain a business license number, which is a uniquely identifying number for the TNC drivers. In addition to that uniquely qualifying or identifying number, driver profiles are available for riders and for enforcement officers by looking at the driver's profile on the platform.
I can apply for a business license tomorrow, not having done any of the background checks or the driver testing, etc.
Right, it's coupled with the driver's profile on a TNC platform.
So there's no permit as such for each driver?
There's not individual permits. The TNCs themselves would receive a company permit, which is subject to full compliance of all of our requirements for drivers, vehicles, among other issues.
But we still have to trust them that they've done all the background checks and the driver testing and such.
It's not just a matter of trust. It's a matter that in order for them to obtain a valid permit within the city of Portland, they have to certify, and we will be regularly auditing and performing enforcement actions for all TNCs and taxis.
Ryan, on that point, enforcement actions, is part of the proposal, so the enforcement's at the end of your presentation and the dollar amounts you're recommending, so we'll hold on.
Sure. Continuing on with the background checks, there was a question from Commissioner Fritz about convictions out of the United States. While we currently do not explicitly perform foreign background checks for taxi drivers. We would also not explicitly conduct foreign background checks for TNCs. However, there are background checks requirements as part of work visas and other citizenship and immigration service documentation.
And did you find the answer about whether it's a five-year residency?
Thank you. Yes, there is no current residency requirement to get a driver's permit.
I believe there is through the taxi companies, though.
They have to have a local address of business.
Right, business license. And they must have a valid driver's license, American driver's license, with a good driving record, cannot have any driver disqualifications within the past 2 years.
So my understanding is at least at Radio Cab, there is a five-year residency requirement for their drivers.
They may apply that as a business practice, but it's not in code.
Let's see. Would we be asking the companies to do the background checks? So, yes, a matter of capacity within the city. So as we explained, with the way that background checks are processed through the LED system, it is an issue of timeliness and staff capacity. But it's also, by allowing third-party background check vendors, it is an attempt to make it a more efficient and timely permitting process for all for-hire transportation operators for both taxis and TNCs. And again, this is not a change in city code. It's really more of a change in the practice and the way that we conduct background checks.
If I may interrupt for a minute. Mayor and colleagues, it occurs to me that I'd like to hear from Chief O'Day and his staff on this issue of the sufficiency of these background checks. So at some point in the next few days, I'd like to pose that question to them and get them thinking about the answer.
Can I ask a question just generally in terms of the legal landscape? So to the extent we're going to be allowing TNCs to self-certify a bunch of things, and we'll set out the code requirements, they'll have to certify to us, yes, we've met these requirements, and then they allow drivers to access their platform. What is their legal liability if, in fact, they have failed to do so and something bad happens in a car? I think it's useful to understand how liability attaches if a self-certification is either not done or is done fraudulently or what have you.
Well, they're going to be held to a standard of negligence, whether they've done something negligently. Subject to the provisions of their user agreements, which we can talk about at some point down the line, they will be subject to liability for their negligence. Now, they're going to be carrying commercial general liability insurance to the tune of $1 million per occurrence and $2 million in the aggregate to cover to cover liability in the course and scope of their work. So presumably the insurance would apply, and that would be their liability.
So there is a section on insurance here, and when Ken gets to that, I think we want to dive into that disclaimer issue in particular.
So again, the remedy would be we would have the right to fine a TNC if they have failed to follow the certification rules. A rider that's involved is injured somehow because of the failure to follow some kind of certification would have a negligence lawsuit against a TNC.
Correct. And I should say fine, suspend, and revoke the TNC company permit.
Are there any other questions about the background checks before we move on to other issues?
Do the FBI checks pick up foreign criminal records?
My understanding is they do not typically.
And again, we have that requirement that a driver must have good 2 years of good driving record, so that in and of itself is some measure of confirmation that a driver has been within the United States and that we are getting some more current information about their criminal backgrounds here in the U.S. Driver testing and training, there are a couple questions about that, and Michael Jacobs from PBOT has looked into these issues.
The first question is, does the driver training require defensive driving? And that is currently not a requirement in our code, so that's not applied to either taxis or LPTs. And so it's something that we could potentially add to the code and add as a requirement for everyone.
But defensive driving is an option of recourse if a driver is found to be in violation or has an offense while already operating as a permitted taxi or LPT driver.
So this section that we have in our notes here, the 40090, is a proposed new section?
That's existing code.
That's existing, yes.
So there is a Bureau-approved driver safety program?
Yes.
It's not a it's not a specific defensive driving course.
Right. So will this these requirements apply to the TNC drivers?
Yes.
And does Lyft and Uber currently require their drivers to have a driver safety program and a test in map reading and code provisions and Portland area attractions?
They do have training and testing materials, but obviously we would want to ensure that their training and testing materials are in complete compliance and are consistent with our testing and training.
So once, if this gets approved, there would be a period of time before you would actually allow them to go live in order to be able to certify that they've done all these things?
Well, actually, I mean, under current code for taxi drivers, they are not required to complete all of this training before they hit the road. They're required to complete it within 6 months of getting their permit.
That's correct.
F is within 6 months, but G, the map reading, the relevant city code and the Portland area attractions is before getting a permit. Well, it used to be knowing the difference between the
Owls,
Rose Garden and the Moda Center.
The Moda Center.
What else do we have?
I noticed that the test in one of the other cities was, do you know which of these things is actually the same thing? So in the olden days, it would have been, is the Rose Garden, where are the two Rose Gardens? Now, of course, we have different names for them, but certainly I would, that's my understanding of the radio cab residency requirement is that people are familiar with the city, not just being able to have a GIS function on their phone.
Commissioner, to answer your question, you're correct that right now, their taxi drivers are required to pass the exam before they can get their permit. The committee recommended that we put that onto the companies to do and to allow them to do it at least during this pilot program within the first 4 months of a driver getting a permit after they've passed their background checks and all of their other checks. One of the longer-term ideas that we're considering that we want to talk more with the task force about is making that exam an online exam so that anybody, anywhere, can go online, register for the exam, and take it, and that information could feed directly to us.
You know, when we have a perfect vendor right here in our hometown, it could help us with that, named Treehouse. It does a lot of online testing.
So I could see having some of the elements maybe be later, but knowing the relevant city code provisions and administrative rules, particularly regarding ADA access and other requirements, seems to me that that should be mandatory before anybody picks up a single passenger.
Great, thank you. Are there any other questions about the driver testing and training before we move on to minimum standards of service? So there were a couple of distinct issues raised as it relates to minimum standards of service. Commissioner Saltzman, you had a question about citywide service and the recommendation to remove the two-thirds requirement prohibition against people kind of circling around the airport. We are very optimistic, and we look forward to collecting a great deal of marketplace data, which would be a requirement for the taxis and TNCs as part of a 120-day program. And from that data, we'd have a real-time look at areas of service, and we would get a full understanding of different parts of town and different levels of service being provided by taxis and TNCs.
And what about the port and TNCs? Do we know any further than we did last week? There seemed to be somewhat of a question mark about
Yeah, so Uber and Lyft have been in negotiations with the Port of Portland. Again, the port has its own regulations for taxis and TNCs on the airport properties. And if the council would like, I'm happy to bring Uber and Lyft representatives up to. Okay.
Actually, I thought we were going to hear from the port. That was part of the reason for the delay.
Unfortunately, I was not able to get information for the port today, from the port today.
So is the intent to have another work session after this?
Why don't we get to the end and then see what Steve...
It's certainly something that I was hoping to hear from the port, and I thought that was why we set the work session out for 2 weeks, to give you time to get folks in.
So I was a little mystified to see this recommendation. Not mystified, that's not the right word, but I was intrigued to see this recommendation of removing the requirement that no more than 65% of drivers be within the radius of the airport. So the task force wants to lift this requirement just to sort of totally, in the spirit of totally deregulating everything for 120 days to see how things shake out. Am I reading that correctly?
Yeah, that was part of the thinking from the task force. Also, quite frankly, we're not enforcing that requirement right now, and city staff does not have data and information on the actual numbers of taxis around the airport. And so we, you know, throughout this, there are a lot of questions that have been raised, and the task force and city staff didn't feel like we had the data and information to make a well-informed decision. And we would like to get that data before final decisions are made, kind of in that phase two. The other question about minimum standards of service had to do about barriers to entry, and appreciate Commissioner Fish for raising these issues, specifically about internet access, and then there was a question about electronic fare payment. The Uber representative mentioned that 96% of Portlanders have access to the internet. The Uber representative clarified that information came from the city's own broadband report, which is included in your binder here. And there is, I think, maybe some more useful information about broadband access. And
having been the co-author of a sponsor of that, that was accessed by libraries and such. That was not personal access.
Right, and as I was just about to say, I think a better piece of information from that report would be to take a look at how many people have smartphones, which report indicates 69% of Portlanders have smartphones. And it's, you know very well, Commissioner Fritz, there's a great deal of information about broadband access within that report, which we included in this binder here.
That doesn't really answer the question, then, that a third of Portland citizens don't have access to a smartphone.
That's true, but I suspect that there's lots of businesses that offer services that only people on smartphones can take advantage of. And I would ask the question whether we prohibit all businesses from offering services that only apply to people with smartphones. And not the entire business, but there's things that you can do with a smartphone that you can't. Make certain payments. I mean, we could say that it's easier for you to make a payment with your smartphone, and that's something that people with a smartphone aren't able to do.
But this entire business is restricted to people with smartphones, and so the question is the equity issue of who is not being served and how do we ensure that they get equitable service?
These service providers, not the entire business.
In Uber and Lyft, services can be accessed outside from a computer, per se. Internet is required, however. And then when it comes to electronic fare payment, there are means to for customers to use electronic fare payment, even if they do not have a bank or they're not interested in signing up for a bank. There are many prepaid debit cards available, and PayPal has a service widely available here in Portland through partnerships with Kroger and 7-Eleven, where individuals can get a prepaid PayPal card and use that for electronic payment. Were there any other questions about minimum standards of service? Okay. Caps on hours. want to defer to Ken.
Commissioner Fritz, you asked a question about the individual who works all day at a particular job and then goes out and drives for a tenancy at night, and whether that was problematic. Currently under the code, that's not prohibited of taxi drivers and LPT drivers. They can work another job so long as it doesn't involve driving or being on duty, and then go work as an LPT or taxi cab driver. So the goal here was to make sure that you couldn't drive for any combination of different LPT, taxi, or TNC drivers more than 14 hours.
I must say, I was so surprised with this answer, and I'm not sure this is something we have to resolve specific to this debate, but I think this probably warrants a revisit at some point, because my guess is that the 14-hour requirement is to guard against people becoming overly tired and inattentive on the road. And if someone's worked an 8-hour shift and then goes into a 14-hour shift, what we're doing is increasing the chances that's not a very safe ride. And I think the medical profession's done a pretty good job policing this, where they started saying that interns should not be working 48-hour shifts. Again, I look at this as, are you alert, and is it a safe ride? Not so much what combination of working hours. But I don't know that we have to resolve that in this context. I just think this rule might warrant some updating.
Yeah, and the task force has already identified this as an issue that they would like to further explore in phase two. Okay.
Perhaps, though, in phase one, I now understand it's about the driving, but if you're driving for UPS or you're driving for somebody else, then surely we don't want you to do more than 6 hours after an 8-hour shift of driving, whether it's driving a taxi cab or whatever, anything else. So is there a way to put something in the regulations that limit driving of any kind?
You know, I think looking at the code language, that we could write an administrative rule that would incorporate driving as driving any kind of vehicle, and be fine that regard with that. The kind of, your point is a fair one, Commissioner Fish. We're now moving from LPT and taxi drivers who do this as their profession to potentially a model where people are doing multiple jobs. This happens to just be one of them. So we will look at everything.
I'm guessing we have some federal rules that would be instructive, since it's heavily regulated, how long you can drive a truck on an interstate. And then we could see what other kinds of driving do they consider excessive on top of the restricted hours for driving a truck. And my guess is the federal law doesn't say you could drive a cab for 12 hours and then go drive a truck for 16 hours.
Yeah, I'm sure there are regulations on that. They're not applicable, but I'm sure that we can model something after them.
All right, if there aren't any other further questions about minimum standards of service, I'd like to get into the insurance piece. And I know that there are many questions about the insurance. Kind of like to initially defer to Ken McGarry again on this issue, and I think it would be helpful to hear directly from the TNCs who have a specific insurance product to cover their activities.
Well, thank you. Going to Exhibit B, I think, is the kind of best place to start, and I'll defer to you whether you want to walk through all types of insurance or whether you want to simply delve into the issue, which is that we talked about last week, which is the period one, which is app on, no match for the TNC vehicle. So I think with regards to, I'll start from the top, with regards to taxis and TNCs, a commercial general liability policy, the task force recommendation was that the same requirements apply to both types of companies. Now, a commercial general liability covers things arising out of, but not limited to, bodily injury, property damage, personal and advertising injury, and contractual liabilities in the course of the permit holder's work under a for-hire transportation company permit. That's generally things other than accidents with the vehicle itself. So for that, the task force recommendation was that the two are equivalent. Now moving on to the commercial auto liability policy. For the periods 2 and period 3, and period 2 is the app is on, a ride has been accepted, and the driver is en route to pick up the passenger. And period 3 is the app is on and the passenger is on board, and it terminates when the passenger leaves the vehicle and the receipt is transmitted. For taxis the Transportation Fairness Alliance correctly pointed out that they are covered by a commercial policy from the moment they leave the garage to the moment they go back into the garage. The standards under the code require a combined single limit of not less than $500,000, although we heard from the industry that they in reality provide more coverage than that at their own choosing, but they're not required to. For periods 2 and periods 3, with regards to the TNCs, again, that is the match has been made and or the passenger is in the car. The task force recommended a commercial automobile liability policy with minimum limits of $1 million per occurrence for death, personal injury, and property. I'm sorry, $1 million in combined single limit coverage and $1 million for under and uninsured motorist coverage.
So why not $1 million and $2 million like the other one?
To mirror the general liability policy,
right?
This is what is standard. Their standard policy in other jurisdictions, the $1 million and $1 million. So, I think that the task force recommendation was mirroring what they do for periods 2 and 3 in other jurisdictions around the country.
I think that's not. Oh, we're not yet to advocacy yet. I'll come back to that. Carry on, sir.
And so then there's the hybrid period, the period 1, where the personal policy and what the PBOT staff here has done is listed the compulsory requirements under Oregon law for all of us who have personal automobiles and are insured, which is $25,000 per person, $50,000 per incident or per crash for bodily injury and death, and $20,000 in property damage. The next column over is PIP coverage, I believe, which is no-fault medical coverage of $15,000, which in today's medical dollars really doesn't get very far. And underinsured, uninsured motorist coverage of $25,000 per person, $50,000 per incident.
So I wanted to see if I can put this into plain English in a real-world context. So this question of whether personal policy applies or not during period 1, just to put a sort of a human face on this. As I read this chart, if I'm in a taxi, it doesn't matter whether it's period 1, 2, or 3, the commercial auto liability insurance kicks in, and if there's an injury, you don't have to argue whether there's coverage, you go to the question of damages.
That's right.
And without going into a big primer on this, the two questions you often deal with in insurance disputes are, is there liability and are damages payable? The liability issue is the hotly contested one because no one wants to admit to liability at the front end. And if there's multiple potential pots, you wait to see who's first. So with the commercial auto liability, you as a customer know that if there's an accident, you're covered. And it doesn't matter as long as it's a cab and there's an accident, there's some commercial liability insurance. So far, so good?
So far, so good.
The question that's been raised about whether under period 1 a personal policy applies or whether and any other periods means that if there is an accident, you're likely to have to get a lawyer if you're involved as a passenger or as a pedestrian, because the first big fight is going to find out who actually is liable.
Mm-hmm.
And the personal insurance provider may very well say, gosh, we don't think we're liable for obvious reasons. And then you kind of look at everyone who's potentially. So one of the potential challenges is here is that you're going to have a lot more legal disputes about liability that's different from whether you have just umbrella commercial auto liability insurance for taxis.
Well, I want to clarify that for period 1, there is now that the major insurers and the transportation network companies have come to an agreement, there is no question about who is the primary insurer for period 1. The TNCs are.
Yeah, I was about to go into this. This is an incredibly quickly evolving area, and your statement was true no less than a few months ago. That there was a significant discussion about which liability policy was responsible during the period in one. As a result of actions in California, the new model is that the TNC coverage is primary at $50,000 per person, $100,000 per crash, and $25,000 in property damage. And that is the proposal that I believe is on the table here and is going to be what the recommendations looked at.
That's the period one.
The period one.
And where do those limits, where do those numbers compare to what Oregon law requires as minimums?
So there is no mandatory compulsory commercial, as I understand it, there is no mandatory commercial liability minimums. But as to the personal minimums, they are just to the left here, 25, 50, and 20. So they're more. I would point out they're obviously they're less than what the taxi cab companies are having, which is full general auto liability at $500,000. In California, as of July 1st, when a new law takes effect, this will be the standard. In addition to this, the TNC company is required to have $200,000 in excess coverage for a total, if you will, of $300,000 per incident. This first piece of 50, 100, and 25 can be worked out in a combination of the TNC driver, the TNC company, or a combination of both. And I think, and I don't want to speak for the task force, but I think that is the model that they were using as the exemplar or the North Star in terms of their recommendations to the City Council.
Why not have the full commercial coverage?
That's a good question. I mean, that's not a legal question so much as a policy question, Commissioner. And I can only tell you that I have looked at 20-some jurisdictions that have regulated TNCs in some way, shape, or form. The 50, 100, 25 is not out of the realm of what else other jurisdictions have done. There are limits that are all over the place, but I have not seen a limit for that period one coverage of 500,000. The most I saw that I can think of off the top of my head, in Seattle, they do have a compulsory requirement of 100,000 per person, 300,000 per incident, and that's a Washington state law.
And so we don't have any law in Oregon yet, though, on this period one. You mentioned California, you just mentioned Washington, but there's nothing
right
in Oregon.
So the Washington law is a little old, little different. It requires any I can't remember the exact term they use, but basically any for-hire carrier. So it's a compulsory law, not for commercial general liability policies. It's a compulsory law for for-hire carriers. So the Seattle City Council chose to apply that standard until the Washington legislature does something different, and they could choose to do something different. I don't follow the Washington. I have a hard enough time following the Oregon legislature. Not that I'm aware of, no.
So who sets the standard here, the Oregon legislature, or do we have some authority or some combination?
You have authority. The Oregon legislature hasn't set any commercial general liability minimums. They haven't set any TNC minimums, to my knowledge.
They haven't set minimums, and we haven't been preempted from regulating?
Correct.
And then let's do the question about why not require full commercial insurance at all times for TNCs. This is a point that has been hotly contested for the past couple of years by the TNCs and the insurers. And you know, what was announced a couple of weeks ago was an agreement by the major insurers and the TNCs that because the risk during period one is distinctly different than risk during other times of commercial activity, that the proposed coverage would adequately cover the risk involved during period one.
Why is the risk not as much? Because I would think that the driver is checking their phone frequently to find out whether they've been asked for a ride.
Yeah, and this is something that the insurers, you know, as part of their risk analysis, they've determined that period one is not does not necessarily mean a driver is in a vehicle actively engaged in a commercial activity. And based on that analysis, they determined that the coverage that Ken just outlined was the appropriate amount of coverage for a TNC driver who had just the app on before a ride was accepted and certainly before a passenger was actually in a vehicle. The insurers.
I think it's fair to say that they are having difficulty underwriting these policies right now. There's not enough data. I mean, the insurance industry, as you know, is full of actuaries who look at and have databases full of crash information and data by which they rate drivers and make policies. And they don't have enough data. Now, I think that's, like I said before, quickly evolving, and you may see the minimums change.
Commissioner Fritz, I just wanted to touch on your specific question was, you had a specific question about concern about personal coverage, a personal policy being canceled when the insurer finds out that you're a TNC driver. And it seems to me that if a driver knows that their insurance has been canceled, then it's illegal for them to be driving, and that's on them. A question that I asked Mr. McGair is, if somebody has an active policy, but they haven't had a discussion with their insurer about whether they're allowed to be a TNC driver, could, when a claim comes in, if somebody's injured and a claim comes in, could the insurance company say, we're denying this claim because we did not know you're a TNC driver, we're in effect retroactively canceling the coverage? And Mr. McGair believes he has an answer to that.
Well, my understanding is that they would pay that claim, but then they would cancel your family's policy. So I think it's irresponsible of us to open our citizens up to having potentially all of your family lose their coverage.
So the question was about what we call app off, an app off claim, even though you're a TNC driver. And assuming that you've made no misrepresentation on your application for your policy, you're right, they would cover the claim. And then they probably would seek to either not renew or cancel the policy with 30 days notice to the driver.
So before we leave the topic of insurance, it probably would be good, or the topic of liability, it'd be good for you to probably dive into the terms of service issues, Ken, if you would.
So I don't know if they're in the notebook,
yes,
or not.
They are exhibits J and K.
And this is a question that I believe Commissioner Fish and also Commissioner Novick raised about the terms of service. This is a copy in under tab J of the Uber terms and conditions, user terms and conditions. So as most of you have used any kind of software product, they ask you to agree to a list of terms and services. This is one for Uber. K are the Lyft terms of service. And we've also verified that Curb, which is the online application that dispatches Portland taxi cabs, also has a similar document, a similar terms of service.
And this is the exhibit J is the California user agreement. Did we get from them the Oregon counterpart?
I don't know that they have an Oregon user agreement right now.
They have a national user agreement, and their attorney is here to speak to the specificity of their terms and service, terms and conditions.
Okay, Commissioner Fish, I want to commend you for taking a look at the terms and conditions, because I think that you've raised an important issue. I mean, you were focusing last week, I think, on the arbitration provision. When I looked at the limitation of liability and disclaimer provisions, I mean, it says, you agree that the entire risk arising out of your use of the services and any service or good requested in connection therewith remains solely with you to the maximum extent practical permitted under applicable law. Uber should not be liable for indirect, incidental, special, exemplary, punitive, or consequential damages, et cetera. even if Uber has been advised of the possibility of such damages. Uber shall not be liable for any damages, liability, or losses arising out of your use or reliance on the services. And then at the end, it says that in no event shall Uber's total liability to you in connection with the services for all damages, losses, and cause of action exceed $500. And I realize that that kind of provision is extremely popular now in corporate America, but I also find it insidious. So this is something that I want us to